investment board that was called on by those pieces of legislation. Our goals today and through the interim and hopefully next session are to kind of take a step backwards, to start over again and looking at the problem and the various alternatives that Alaska has, and looking at different ways of structuring its investment strategies or its investment procedures for these FERS and TERS monies. And of course, these monies are expected to grow tremendously, as they have in other states, over the indefinite future. Today, we have Anchorage and Fairbanks on the teleconference today, and I think we have Representative Kopanen. Are you with us in Fairbanks?
Yes, I'm here, and we have seven people listening in.
Well, welcome, and Nilo, if you have questions of witnesses as we proceed, please feel free to break in and let us know. With us in Anchorage is, in addition to myself, Senator Porchel, we have Senator Adams, who serves on the State Affairs Committee, and we are expecting Representative Fran Ulmer, who I think is hopefully in town, and we're expecting her here in Anchorage. Is there anybody in Juneau online? Well, we may be joined by other people in Juneau later. There's a copy of the agenda in the back of the room, and how we've structured this is hopefully has some rhyme or reason to it. We wanted to begin to hear from some of our legislative budget and audit folks and our research people who have looked into this issue over the last year, who have issued some reports, and really last year had set the stage for pointing the direction of doing something different. And I thought it'd be helpful to start with those reports and that research as some background and overview of kind of how we got to the point that we did get to and what some of the alternatives are out there. We also have invited some people from other states, particularly we have a PERS operation officer from Nevada, we have the director of the State Investment Board from Washington State, and we have an investment consultant who recently testified or presented some information before a joint PERS and TERS board meeting here last month, Mr. Richard Enos, and he is also going to be online, and to conserve the teleconference, we're going to bring those people online instead of making them wait through the whole teleconference portion of this. So we're going to hear from them, and then we have our own Commissioner of Revenue, Commissioner of Administration here to hear from, as well as representatives of private investment companies and some of the beneficiaries of the PERS and TERS system. And hopefully we'll have time at the end for public testimony. We will have time. We'll stay here as long as there's interest in people testifying, but there are a number of people here signed up to testify in advance and probably others desiring to testify, so if we could, I would ask all the witnesses to keep their remarks as brief as possible, recognizing that it is a fairly complex matter and complex issue that we're going to be getting into. Well, we have been joined by Representative Fran Ulmer. Welcome. Representative Ulmer was a leading proponent in the House of Representatives last session in developing an independent board structure for investment, has been a leader in the issue in the House. And also, we have you to thank for getting some of the House research information to us, and we sure appreciate that. And we're going to hear from House research and summarizing some of that information today. I think also in the back of the room we had a sheet of paper that kind of has some of the policy issues outlined. And this isn't all the issues or all the problems raised or to be addressed, but they are some of the questions that arose last year in the discussion of the several bills. And it would be helpful for those people testifying today if you had specific suggestions on any of those questions on either the format of the or the composition of an independent board or what that should look like, whether it should include beneficiary service and benefits management in addition to investment responsibilities, that would be very helpful. And we are, to repeat kind of what I started out saying, we are developing new legislation for next year. It's my hope that we look at all the suggestions that we get here, as well as in writing or in person in the month ahead. We'll probably, just in an effort of trying to develop the most workable, best piece of legislation we can initially, we're going to be sending out draft legislation to people who are here today or are interested in it, and we would welcome your comments on that draft legislation so that it might be perfected even prior to its introduction in January. Probably, as Representative Ulmer and Senator Adams can also attest to, that there will undoubtedly be further changes in any legislative piece as it moves through the legislature. But I think this is an area that cannot be billed as someone's personal piece of legislation or something that any one person is going to get any particular credit for, so that it's something that needs the input of everybody, and I'm sure it certainly will get, like last year, well debated in the legislature. Senator Adams or Representative Ulmer, do you have any opening remarks or comments? Well, why don't we get started? I'd like, if I could, to ask Mr. Bilden to come forward. He is an auditor with our legislative budget and audit, and we had a budget report done for us last year, dated June 19, 1989, that really precipitated a lot of this, the interest in this, and perhaps you could summarize some of your findings and recommendations in that audit, as well as if you have had any opportunity to look at, now that we're a year down the road, where are we in regard to some of the observations that you had a year ago?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Bilden.
Bob, just a moment. The people in the back are having a little trouble hearing. Maybe if we could ask people, so that Bob faces both the audience and you, would you be comfortable with that? They're having trouble hearing, and we can't turn up the loudspeakers. Would that work?
Yeah, maybe. You think it's going to be better if it goes over the
At least.
Okay. Maybe we can get our witnesses to go over to this, what's called number two mic here.
I'm Bob Bilden with the Division of Legislative Audit, and a year and a half ago we did do an audit report on the PERS and TERS funds in response to public allegations that those funds were being mismanaged and the Treasury Division was using deceptive accounting practices. Our review showed no basis for those claims. But what we did learn was that the Treasury Division was providing inadequate oversight over the management of those funds when we compared that to how other states were managing their public employees' funds. We surveyed most all states and found that almost all of them have some sort of a board, an oversight review independent of the investing function. The main thrust of our audit report was a recommendation that Board of Trustees concept be a setup similar to the permanent fund, to provide that independent review provide some management over those funds. We also found that the way that the Treasury Division's I have a little of the Juno bug. We found the way that the Treasury Division was reporting the results of their operations was not very informative. It's a complex issue. We brought in a private contractor to review those for us, and he had difficulty understanding them. We recommended that they expand the performance results reporting, and I'm happy to report that they have done that. Our third recommendation dealt with an interpretation of an accounting practice, and they have since corrected that also.
Senator Adams?
In your report here that you have submitted to the legislature, what type of funds are you looking at this Board of Trustees should be looking at? And the type of organization that the makeup should be on the Board of Trustees? Should it be independent of appointments by the governor and within its commissioners, or should it be a makeup of the public and also commissioners? What did you put down in your report here?
We believe that both the employer and employee interest should be represented on the board to get the employer interest in there. I would presume we would have gubernatorial appointments.
And as far as the fund, do you want all the fund to be managed or partial portions?
The entire fund would be managed or overseen by this board.
Bob, I was interested that in your original report, you were really talking about an outside oversight with continued investment by the Department of Revenue. Is that right?
Yes.
And somewhere along the line, we moved really in moving the investment, the investment operation itself also into a proposed independent body. Was there some particular feeling that was not desirable, or you were just looking at the first step?
Well, our report, which generated a LBNA-sponsored bill to create an investment board, had the Treasury Division still responsible for the actual investing. However, that investing would have been at the direction of the board. They would have established the investment policies, guidelines, and Treasury Division would have followed up on that. The other bills that take that investing function away from the Treasury Division and place it within the corporation or other functional area would still achieve the same benefit, I believe.
The other question I had related to your second or third recommendation dealing with the format of the so-called independent or outside performance review. And I guess I was a little bit troubled. We, in our legislative consideration, I think we're all thinking in terms of having a requirement for regular, professional, outside performance reviews. I guess I'm a little concerned that you could say those words somehow and still perhaps have an executive director or even board members designing the structure of the information or designing the format of a, quote, independent outside performance review. Is there ways of ensuring that that doesn't happen? That you have the same kind of performance review that the Ford Foundation or anybody else would get if they contracted with one of the several national auditors in this field?
Yeah, from what I understand, that's achievable. It's kind of like, I believe it's kind of like an audit. Auditors come in and look at the books, and they do their things in accordance with standards. I believe a fund evaluation can be done the same way. We, as the audit report points out, we were a little bothered too that the funds were evaluated partially, independently. It was incomplete, but I believe now that it's a total fund review and it's an expanded analysis, and I believe that that is independent of the board, or I mean the management of the funds.
It's kind of coming back to me in the bill that I think stemmed from this. I believe, wasn't it in the LB&A bill that had the words even in a customary and traditional manner or something like that in the law for the performance review? Is that necessary, I mean, to ensure that, or was this just a very odd case?
The bill was in response to what we saw at that time. As to whether or not that type of language is necessary, I don't know, but I don't think it hurts having it in there to reinforce the desire and the need for that type of evaluation.
What would be a time frame, do you think, for performance review? What would you see one as being necessary to be required every year or every 2 years or every 5 years? Or?
I would think at least annually, if not in interim periods. Yes. It's a report, but it's a report to interested people how the fund is doing, and I think the timely analyses are beneficial.
Other questions of Mr. Bilger? Thank you very much. Next person we have is Gordon Harrison, who heads our legislative research organization, and we've asked him through Representative Ulmer to have Mr. Harrison look at other states and other alternative structures for investment. Mr. Harrison, we'd sure appreciate if you could review your work on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Adams, Representative Ulmer. My name is Gordon Harrison. I'm director of the Legislative Research Agency. Let me say what I hope to accomplish here, and I'll try to do it as fast as I can without being too tedious. My intent is to try to give some overall perspective on the proposal that received a good deal of legislative interest and activity last year that originated in the Department of Revenue for the creation of a public corporation, an actual state trust company for investment. What I have tried to do is stand back from that proposal a little bit and assess what other options there might be to accomplish some of the same objectives of that proposal. I'm not advocating any particular option, and I don't find any particular fault with the Department of Revenue proposal. Let me preface what I'm going to say with the observation that I don't pretend to any particular expertise in the area of managing retirement funds, institutional investing, and so on. What I do know about it, I've acquired mainly in the pursuit of research that I did on this memo for Representative Ulmer. And I didn't look in any detail at any particular proposal. That can come later in discussion. Some of these things is best done by people in the audience and online who are experts in some of these areas. My point of departure was the Department of Revenue proposal. I think it was your committee's bill, SB 509, introduced last session. It was to create a public corporation, much like the permanent fund, whose purpose would be to invest the endowment or the trust funds of the state. trust, what are the trust funds of the states? Well, they are primarily pension funds. They're primarily PERS funds, TERS funds, some other smaller retirement funds. Supplemental benefits system. The non-retirement funds are really very small. The numbers that I was looking at showed them to be less than 3% of the over $5 billion in state trust funds that were to be managed by this public corporation. Therefore, the proposal really raises the broader question of the management of retirement systems. There's more than just the investment of trust funds or the investment activity. We're also looking at retirement systems because those assets are, of course, very important to the retirement systems. There are two basic models for the governance of retirement systems. One is the state agency model. The other is the public corporation model. The state agency model bifurcates the retirement systems into the administration of the benefits and the investment of the assets of the system and assigns them to line agencies of the state. The Alaska system is a classic state agency sort of model. Benefits of the PERS and TERS and other retirement systems are assigned to the Department of Administration, the Division of Retirement Benefits. The investment of the money is assigned to the Department of Revenue, and more specifically, the Commissioner of Revenue. The corporate model integrates the benefits and the investment of assets into one organization. It would be like having an Alaska Railroad Corporation strictly for the retirement system. There are a number of states that successfully use that system, and I will get to that in a minute. The point of this is that the Department of Revenue proposal for the trust company, state trust company, was a major step away from the current line agency, government agency model that we have now, but it did not go all the way to the integrated corporate retirement system. It creates a separate organization for the management and investment of the assets, but it leaves intact the state agency Division of Retirement Benefits that oversees the administration of benefits. That proposal, and I'll get into this, is creates basically a state investment board. These are very common. The state that has a mechanism much like the one proposed by the Department of Revenue is Wisconsin, as near as I can tell. And I must confess that my contact with some of these states was more or less superficial. I didn't have a great deal of time, and it's hard to distinguish some of the nuances of their autonomy and so on from telephone conversations. But the Wisconsin investment, state investment board is highly autonomous. It's a public corporation. It has an independent identity, high degree of professional recognition, independent from the administrative structure and so on, in ways very much like the original Department of Revenue proposal. Before I mention some alternatives to that particular approach, let me summarize quickly the objectives of the proposed reform. By the department and by others who are interested in this subject, legislative audit and so on. One, there is the attempt to insulate investment decisions from political influences of the governor's office. Second, to prevent a commissioner or a treasurer who is acting alone as a sole fiduciary from making imprudent investments. these, and I don't mean single individual investments that go sour, because any investor is going to do that, but a pattern of imprudence in investing. And these could result from well-meaning error in judgment or something worse. And third, there was the effort to enhance the professionalism and the efficiency of the investment enterprise. Well, I think some of those, more or less, those objectives could be achieved more or less by different approaches. And I'll mention a few. A sort of minimalist reform effort, one which would leave the treasurer or the commissioner as the sole fiduciary of the state trust funds, endowment funds, but would do something more than exists today, would be, I think, to sort of enshrine in ringing statutory language safeguards against imprudence or impropriety on the part of the commissioner, and sort of load him up with formal reporting, disclosure requirements, what he's doing and why he's doing it, and so on. And in the memo, I suggest that in statute, the commissioner could be required to prepare a formal statement of investment policy and long-term strategy for each fund, provide an opportunity for the public to comment on these statements before he adopts them, require him to make more elaborate and more frequent reports on his investment activity and to distribute them to a wider audience, impose on the commissioner and his investment staff a stricter code of ethics and higher conflict of interest standards, provide an explicit statutory definition of the standard of loyalty that is implicit in the prudent man rule. These sorts of things basically make it very, very clear in statutory language what is expected of the commissioner, hoops that he should go through in formulating investment strategies and executing those strategies and so on. Another step that could be taken that would, again, leave the status quo intact, that is to say, leave the commissioner in charge of the investing in these funds, but increase the accountability and the visibility of what he's doing, would be to create in statute an investment advisory council. This would be an outside board. I guess this is the idea that, put forth by the Division of Legislative Audit. You would bring in outside experts to advise the commissioner and review his investment activity. It could be a 3 or 4 person board. It could be more. It could include representatives or beneficiaries of the systems of the retirement funds that are being invested. And you could give it some statutory role, not necessarily substantive powers, but you could maybe require it to prepare its own report to the legislature. You could require the commissioner to consult with the board in formulating investment strategies and so on. I think that could do a lot to sort of shine light on the investment activities of the commissioner. Another alternative, and very similar to what is being proposed or what was proposed by the Department of Revenue, would be the creation of an estate investment board, but you could give it less organizational structure, less, in fact, you wouldn't even have to give it an organization. You could create an investment board which was the fiduciary. It would replace the commissioner as the fiduciary for these funds, but it wouldn't necessarily have its own organization, its own investment staff, and so on. Or if you did give it its own staff, investment professionals, and so on, they could be much more closely integrated into state government than the original proposal. That is to say, they would not be a public corporation, and so on. and have those other trappings of independence and autonomy. The Oregon Investment Council, as I understand it, is an investment board that that oversees basically the Department of the Treasury. It oversees the activities of the Treasury staff. It doesn't have its own organization. It is the fiduciary and is responsible for the investment, but it doesn't have its own organization. Again, my knowledge of these things is somewhat superficial, and maybe Mr. Rigg, who's on the online in the Washington system, can speak to this, but there is, I guess, something of a problem of a dual reporting relationship of the Treasury staff, because the treasurer is the head of the Treasury staff, but so is the board. So there's a little ambiguity there. But in any case, it's a means of creating a multiple fiduciary without a new staff, and that may be something you'd want to look at. The Washington Investment Board is a state agency that is has its own professional identity and its own organizational identity. It doesn't have the full measure of autonomy that the Wisconsin Board does, for example, and even, I think, the Permanent Fund Board does here. So that is certainly a variation of the department proposal that's very workable. I should say that a lot of states have investment boards, but many of them are not what is being proposed here. Many of them are, in effect, constitutional officers. They're all ex officio officers. The governor, the attorney general, and the auditor, or the governor, the treasurer, and the department of commissioner of department administration, something like that.
Jordan, could I stop you on that
Sure.
point? This is a real small point that I know I've been confused on over the years. It seems like we always get confused in legislation. Ex officio just means they serve as another, they're a cabinet officer.
It means they serve by virtue of their office, that they are a member, they're a full voting member, but they are a member only by virtue of the fact that they hold a particular office. So the commissioner of administration is an ex officio board member. That means that as long as that individual is occupying that position, he sits on that board. If a new person is appointed to that position, he sits on the board.
So you can have voting or non-voting ex officio members.
It doesn't have anything to do with voting. They're voting members. But it means that they sit by virtue of occupying their office. Okay. So in those situations, I don't think that wants to be... That certainly would not be an improvement on the existing situation. It may even be worse, in my view, if one of your objectives is to distance investment activity from the extraneous political influences in the governor's office and so on. Not all state investment boards are alike. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Okay, then you could, another option, one which would require a more substantial change to the status quo, is to go beyond the Department of Revenue proposal, the investment board, and actually integrate the retirement system, the benefits, and the assets under one organization, create a public corporation that's responsible for all aspects of the retirement system. And frankly, that makes a lot of sense organizationally. That is to say, the organizational logic for integrating the benefits and the asset management is very strong, if not compelling. The benefit side of a retirement system represents basically the liabilities of the system. And the investment side represents the assets of the system. And those have to be managed in harmony, one with a view to the other. And when you bifurcate institutionally or organizationally those two functions, you're creating a problem for there to be good communication and good coordination between the two very important aspects of the system, which have to be, as I say, managed jointly. I spoke with several directors of these integrated systems, and they were very, very strong advocates for this type of an organization, because benefit management and asset management are integral parts of a retirement system. The argument is made that investing money is an entirely different activity from managing benefits and all the record keeping and so on that goes on the benefit side. That doesn't seem to me to be too convincing an argument, in that most corporate organizations, certainly industrial corporations, have a lot of different activities within the corporate framework. Things that are quite different, product engineering and marketing, for example, they require different people, different skills. But they still need to be coordinated by a single policy board or a single director. Well, there are some other advantages of a more practical type that can be advanced for this integrated system, and I won't go into those. The Department of Administration might want to talk more about this. And my point here is not to argue for this, but to point out that it is a very workable system, and that it has been used, is being used successfully in a number of states, Colorado and Ohio I talked to, and I understand we're going to hear from Nevada. It is certainly an option. Well, that's a very quick summary of what I prepared for Representative Ulmer, and it's in there, and I won't dwell on any of this. If there are any questions on me, I'd be glad to. Questions of Mr. Harrison?
Gordon, I had a couple of questions. One is that I liked your discussion of the integrated organization and how it need not be so diverse as to be logically handled by a single board. I kind of thought back a little on the corporate structure that at least one of the proposals last year that we looked at that would involve on the board the use of, quote, professional investors. And I was trying to apply that type of board composition to an integrated function that would involve benefits, and I had a hard time visualizing some outside guy being paid $300 a day to come up from New York or Chicago, sit on the board for investments, and be asked to determine whether or not people should retire with such and such disability or make those kind of benefit calls.
Well, the boards that I did look into, mainly the Ohio and the Colorado board, they are made up virtually exclusively of representatives from the retirement systems, the beneficiaries. And they don't attempt to include investment expertise on their boards, their policy boards, and they then train or expose the board members to training. Courses, seminars, Wharton School has training programs for board members of retirement systems. The Colorado person I was talking to, the investment officer there, was saying that at every monthly board meeting, they have a special program, a presentation on a technical aspect of the system for the benefit of the board. So they don't attempt to bring expertise to the board, but they try to enhance the understanding of the board members of technical matters once they're there.
I was also, that kind of touches on my second question. I was kind of impressed by at least the examples that you gave, recognizing you were, you know, just kind of calling around, that the public members of the board, they would have a requirement oftentimes of having investment expertise or having financial competency of some kind, but the pay didn't did not, at least from your examples, didn't seem to be indicative of the level of expertise they attracted or didn't attract, or the requirements that they imposed, that most of the states, at least that you cited, had, you know, fairly modest compensation regardless of the qualifications of the members required.
I found that there was in no case did I find any significant compensation given to board members. It was all public service, and I asked many board representative systems about that, and they said they had no trouble attracting qualified people, and that there was a desire basically to serve the public. Compensation was insignificant in all these places. Washington has a very interesting system where theirs is just it's not an integrated system, it's a state investment board. It's a 14-member board, however, I think that's right, 14 members. Anyway, five of the members are non-voting members, and they are supposed to be required to have 10 years' experience or, anyway, some measure of expertise in investment matters. And apparently there's no problem filling those positions, and those people make a substantial contribution to the deliberations of the board. Many of them are retired. There's an academic member and a person who's investing another fund, so there's no conflict of interest on his part. But you know, in those states, of course, there is probably a much larger pool of investment experts around. There are major metropolitan centers, and you know, in Alaska, it might be more difficult to find a pool of potential board members with expertise that would be willing to serve.
Maybe we'll ask some people out here in the audience. Mr. Harrison, thank you very much. We've been joined by Representative Larson. Welcome.
I apologize for being late.
Glad to have you. Are we hooked up now? Hopefully, Mr. Pine, are you in line, online with us from Nevada? George Pine?
Right, I'm here. Can you hear me?
We sure can. We would welcome your thoughts on the operations that you oversee in Nevada and maybe some of the strengths and weaknesses as you see it in your own system. If you have any weaknesses, maybe you don't.
Well, I'll just give you some background, I guess, about the system, and then any questions you might have, feel free to ask me, okay?
Please proceed.
And I was listening to some of the comments of the speaker before me. Were similar to one of the types of systems that he was talking about there at the end in terms, I guess, of what you would call an integrated system. We have a 7-member retirement board that's appointed by the governor. These board members are not really compensated. I think they get $80 a day for attendance and some per diem reimbursement. They are members of employee and employer groups. Three of them are represent employees of public employee associations. Three of the board members are from public employer management representatives, such as maybe the chief financial officer of the city of Las Vegas, perhaps might be an appointee. And then we have one retiree member, and that makes up the 7-member board. And they are in charge, certainly they are a body corporate, and they are in charge of not just the administration of the system. And what I mean by that is, maybe ruling on disability retirement matters and ruling on challenges to statute or policy or staff's interpretation, I guess I should say, of those types of things. And they have the powers to correct errors and inequities that occur by staff. But they also are in charge of investing the money of the retirement system also. And I think that they, although investments may be considered more glamorous or whatever the term may be, I think they have a real good feel and understanding for both sides, and that they address the administrative matters with equal diligence as they do matters of investments. The system, just by point of background, has about 52,000 members of state and local government. We've got, and we talk about what we project in terms of type of thing. We relate that to the type of investment return we would have to meet the benefits promised by the retirement system. And this seminar, which we just conducted, is a great educational process to the board. In addition, similar to what I think the speaker just referred to in Colorado, each month when we have a bond manager or a stock manager come in to talk about his performance, he also provides the board some education regarding some aspect of his particular discipline. Presently, our system has about 36 staff members. The portfolio is about $3.5 billion. We probably pay out about $7 million in money manager fees each year. Typically, the board meeting days are 2 days long, and I would say that about half of the time is devoted to investments, and the other half to what I would consider administrative matters. I don't know if I'm talking too much or what to this point. I guess I could go on or answer any questions.
Well, Mr. Pine, that has been very helpful. I think we might even have some more questions regarding some of the specifics of your system. It does sound to be a very lean integrated system. You answered some of the questions that I had on how do you make up for, how do you instill the financial expertise in your board, and I was kind of wondering on picking outside managers or outside financial consultants, how is that done vis-a-vis in-house or board capabilities?
Sure, okay. Yeah, basically something I forgot to tell you here. Okay, the board selects an executive officer who you may know as Will Keating. He then he appoints an investment officer and an operations officer. I'm the operations officer. The investment officer works with a consultant presently from Callan Associates in San Francisco, and that consultant assists our investment officer in managing the portfolio, discussing what the asset allocation should be. Certainly, you're always talking about managing risk versus return, complementary investment styles, and that type of thing. Then it's staff's responsibility to go to the board, perhaps, and say, it might not be a bad idea to hire a passive stock manager or a growth manager or, you know, whatever the case may be, because by doing this, we can perhaps reduce that risk a little bit and increase the return and meet in a more safer way the objectives of the retirement system. And the staff and the consultant would provide this to the retirement board at a meeting, and then the board might decide, okay, maybe we should select an active growth manager or something in stocks. Callan Associates would then go out, and they would go out to their database of all the people that would fit this, and they would sort of weed out the types of money managers in terms of their background and expertise and how much money that they manage, and to see if they would sort of fit the bill for the type of manager we're looking for. Five or six managers maybe make a presentation to the board as to how they invest, what their style is, what their past track record is, et cetera, and then the board would select one of those managers, and then those managers on a quarterly basis would be reviewed for performance, and typically over, I guess, what they call a full market cycle. And they're reviewed to make sure they adhere to their investment style and that type.
Mr. Pine, thank you. We have been joined by Representative Steve Rieger, and Steve also has been one of the real interested people in the House, but unfortunately we're not going to see your services next year, but welcome. Other questions of Mr. Pine?
Thank you so much for standing by and contributing. We really appreciate your input.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
The next person hopefully staying by online is David Wigg, Director of State Investment Board of State of Washington. Mr. Wigg, are you online with us?
Yes, I am.
We would sure appreciate hearing a description of your system and how investments are handled and some of the composition of your board and strengths and weaknesses of that system as you might see them.
Okay. Don't repeat some items that your staff may have already covered or you may be aware of. Please feel free to interrupt me to focus on exactly what you would like to hear from us. I guess my only preliminary remarks would be that in structuring an organization, I would think that you would want to look for three goals. That when you create an organization to manage pension assets, you want to make sure that the maximum attention they will devote to the investment program and not be distracted by any other administrative or other type of distractions that might adversely affect the focus on the investment program. A second one, which is contained in many legislation bills that create investment functions, is to maximize return at a prudent level of risk. And a third would be to focus exclusively on investments for the interest of the beneficiaries. So if I had to focus on three goals, I'd focus on those three. And obviously one can structure an organization in any number of ways. And I think as you survey the 50 states, you might have as many as 40 different models covering these same three goals. The Washington State Investment Board was created in 1981. And the investment mandate was changed from a legal list to what is often called a prudent person rule. We have a lay board of nine members, nine legal trustees, if you will. And then we have an expert advisory committee consisting of five individuals that is appointed by that nine-member board. At the time the board was created, there was a consolidation of the investment of several distinct public trust funds. The three major retirement funds within our state were each had a different advisory board. Well, they were all consolidated in one office here. So the Washington State Investment Board presently has investment authority for all public pension systems in the state. Three large cities were grandfathered out of that system. In addition to the pension funds, we also have our second largest pool of assets is for our workman's compensation program. And then the third and much smaller collection of assets are various trust funds. Now back to the nine-member board. We have four representatives that represent the retirement systems. An active member of the public employees retirement system, one active member from teachers retirement system, active member of the law enforcement and firefighter system, and then any a retired member from any public system. We have three ex officio members. One, the director of the Department of Retirement Systems, which is the administrative arm which manages the benefit side of the retirement programs. The director of the Department of Labor and Industries, the representative of the Workmen's Compensation Funds, and then the state treasurer. We have two legislators, one senator and one representative. The appointing authority for these nine members, the governor appoints three of the retirement representatives. The other retirement representative not appointed by the governor is appointed by the superintendent of public instruction, that being the teacher representative. And obviously the governor appoints his two directors. The state treasurer is elected statewide. And then the legislators are appointed by the heads of their respective bodies. Before I move away from the structure, are there any particular questions?
Mr. Wick, I had one question. Because there are no public members per se appointed, but the five non-beneficiary people that would include the three ex officios and the two legislators, what in a typical board meeting are those five people? Are they normally there in person, or do they have designees? And how active are they in the actual investment goal setting or strategies of the board?
In a trustee environment, according to our legal counsel, the designation of a trustee cannot be delegated. So each of our nine designated trustees cannot delegate their responsibility. So of those five members that you focused on, the directors of the two departments, the state treasurer and the legislators, they themselves have to be there to vote if they are going to vote, and they cannot delegate that responsibility. Did that answer your question?
Well, that was part of it, and the second part is how active are they in typical board meetings? I mean, are they, it's kind of, I don't want to pose a negative question. I guess the question that arises is, are people who have other day-to-day operations, do they come prepared, and are they vital members of a board?
Our experience has been somewhat mixed. Since we've only been in existence for 9 years, up until about 2 years ago, there was a fairly consistent core of individuals. Speaking to one, the senator who was appointed really loved the function. Was formerly a stockbroker himself, and was quite personally involved in the field of investing. And he never missed a meeting, not even an advisory committee meeting that he could make. On the other hand, some other members have had, let's say, below 50% attendance when they were fairly busy and couldn't make the board's meetings. So the attendance has been spotty, and I think it's a function of the interest of the individual at that point.
Other questions at this point? If not, feel free to proceed if you had other comments.
Okay. I didn't talk about the expert advisory committee, but each one of those five individuals, according to the statute, has to be experienced and qualified in the field of investments. They also cannot have any conflicts of interest, no active members of any financial organization, be it a bank, a mortgage servicer, or a financial service organization. So we don't have the active stockbrokers. Majority of our advisory members are retired. The majority of the board, of those expert advisory committee members, have been retired over the entire life of the board. In fact, the current incumbents, the only two individuals that are not retired is one academic and then one assistant treasurer of a corporation which is headquartered in Seattle. So we tend to historically have been using a lot of retired but very skilled individuals that have definitely contributed to the development of our investment program. And even though I didn't offer too many remarks, that expert advisory committee has been invaluable. As far as the investment process, when I hopped on the line, I believe the individual from Nevada was discussing a little bit about the investment process. If I could just quickly cover ours. Any one investment idea can come from any of the three. I'll break up our organization into the three parts. There's the board members, who are the legal trustees, the investment advisory committee, the expert advisors, and then the staff. And each group and each individual has its own networks, if you will. And any one investment idea or concept or strategy can originate at any one of the three spots. However, once the idea is brought to the fore, then the staff is assigned to prepare whatever materials are needed. It goes every single investment. kind of external managing fiduciary, whether that's a active stock manager, a passive stock manager, a developer partner on the real estate, whatever it might be. There's somebody who is managing the equity investments. Now, that doesn't leave the staff out. The staff is very active and have the hands-on responsibility for these specific investments. But we definitely are looking over the shoulder of every single equity manager on a regular basis. So there's two equity professionals who we execute all trades by our stock managers. We execute, obviously, all trades on the fixed income as well. We have two professionals focused on real estate. We're fairly large and fairly active on the real estate side. And then I guess we have one utility individual, that being me, the executive director, that gets involved in all asset classes. That really concludes my prepared remarks, unless there's anything I could respond to.
Yeah, we have a couple of questions. Representative Ulmer?
Thank you. I'd just like to return to the first point that you made with regard to the three goals that you recommend we consider, and that was that maximum attention be devoted to the investment decisions as opposed to the administration or management concerns. That goal, I think, is a very worthwhile one we need to concentrate on. And I guess the integrated system raises the question that immediately comes to mind, can a board that has both the management and the investment decisions stay away from being preoccupied with sort of ministerial functions? That concerns me, and I'm just wondering how you have structured your meetings and how you've structured your responsibilities to avoid that. I guess in part the answer might be just the creation of the expert panel, but I'd like to hear a little more discussion on that, if you would, please.
I'd be glad to. Our sole responsibility is the investment function, so we virtually do not get involved in any of the administrative issues, nothing on the benefit side. I mentioned one of our board members is the director of the Department of Retirement Systems, and that's his full-time job. But in our board meetings, they're totally focused on the investment side. Now, we bring in the state actuary, who really reports to a joint legislative committee, where to get a better understanding of the liabilities. Occasionally, certain benefit issues are brought to our attention, but virtually the vast majority, 90-odd% of all discussions at the board level are focused specifically on investments or investment-related activities.
In your state, each of the beneficiary groups have their own boards that deal with those questions.
Totally on the investment side, I'm not really up to speed or capable of responding to who deals with the beneficiary issues. However, having just said that, being a senior veteran of state government here, there is a joint committee for pension policy that the legislature created that is very active. It meets once a month, and if legislative action is needed, the four caucuses, if you will, sit on that committee and are constantly dealing with beneficiary issues.
Mr. Wigg, I had a couple of follow-up questions on your expert advisory committee. How are those people selected? How are they compensated? And do you have any trouble recruiting people to serve?
Okay, hitting your middle question first, the compensation is almost an embarrassment from my point of view. It's $50 a meeting. So they're not serving for the income. Well, at the present time, we have these five expert advisors. Two of them have had more than 10 years of service in an advisory capacity, so obviously they have a public service cause which they have responded to. They have been invaluable to us. As far as recruiting new investment advisory members, we definitely seem to find folks who are interested in serving. We have a fairly broad personal disclosure and so even those who have accumulated a fair amount of assets at least are not averse to filling out their personal disclosure information as well. So we have not found that to be defining people who can definitely add a network and add value to our investment program. So we have found individuals.
The other part of the question was, who makes the selection or how are selections made?
Excuse me, I forgot that. The nine-member legal trustees select and appoint the investment committee members. There's three-year terms on a rotational basis. That was all set out in the statute.
Qualitative question. Could you comment on what you would, how you would describe the approach towards risk or the riskiness of your portfolio? Would you describe it as relatively moderate or high or low risk? I mean, how aggressively are you going out to reach for yields? And also, could you give just in real round numbers, maybe an idea of how much of your portfolio is into fixed incomes, how much into stocks, and how much into real estate?
Sure. When the board was first created, I may give you a little longer answer, but I think that the evolution of our portfolio is important. When the board was created, there was the statutory limitation on exposure to equities, so we could only have 25% of the portfolio in common stocks. The board took a very aggressive stance, immediately increased the exposure to common stock, added alternative equity programs. I believe it's we're the nation's largest investor in leveraged buyouts, which are our best performing asset class. We've been involved in venture capital. We have opened the door and funded venture capital, and we have closed that door and funded and not funded venture capital partnerships. So we're very sensitive to the expected returns in each asset class. I'd say we're fairly aggressive in almost every single asset class. Let me go down each one and then perhaps comment on it. As far as the long-term fixed income, we're about 35% in bonds, and we definitely make interest rate bets. Not so much credit bets in that area as much as interest rate bets. On the common stock area, we have a total of 31% in common stock. And we have been much larger in the past. We sold $2 billion in stocks prior to October 87. That's the good news. The bad news, we didn't get back in November as much as we wanted to. But so we don't mind moving around a bit. We believe strongly in passive markets, so about two-thirds of our common stock exposure is in what's called indexed or passive products. We just buy the market. We have about 3% in venture capital, 10% in leveraged buyouts. We have a tactical asset allocation, which our managers move between stocks, bonds, and cash, of about 5%. The area where we were slow to getting to the party is in the global markets, where we only have 1%. And in real estate, we have 10%, and that's definitely a growing program. We don't participate in real estate the way most pension funds do. We co-invest with developer partners so that they get their fees and their income at the same time we do at the end of the investment.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, thank you very much. We sure appreciate your time and providing us guidance here today. Thank you very much.
Certainly, my pleasure. Thank you.
The next person that we have on teleconference is Richard Ennis, and Mr. Ennis was asked, I think, by the Department of Revenue here about a month ago to make a presentation before the Joint PERS and TERS Board, and I had the pleasure of attending that and listening to him, and he's agreed to kind of reiterate some of his remarks that he gave at that time again, which I felt were very informative and very helpful. Mr. Ennis, are you online with us?
Senator Porchel.
Yes. Yeah, please proceed. I don't know what advice or instructions you were given, but I think that some of the comments that you made here in person last month would be very helpful to us today.
Be happy to try to do that. When I received the invitation to speak with you today, a couple of areas were indicated that might be productive for me to address. One had to do with the investments with the Alaska Permanent Fund, and another had to do with the relevance and operation of the prudent person rule. So those are a couple of things I'll speak to succinctly, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions that you all might have. The Alaska Permanent Fund is a remarkable institution, and one I'm sure all Alaskans are quite proud of. It does not appear to me to be the best place to locate the investment of the teachers and public employee pension funds, however, and there seem to be several reasons to suggest that the pension trust funds might be best invested separately. One issue is the relative size differential of the Alaska Permanent Fund and the two much smaller pension fund portfolios. In any investment organization, the various portfolios to be tended compete for the time of the staff, and invariably the largest portfolios get the greatest attention. And I think that there would be the potential for the pension funds to get somewhat less attention than they might otherwise. A second reason is that there are different investment functions involved between the permanent fund, which in effect is an endowment, and the pension funds, which are basically trusts of assets put aside by taxpayers and public employees to collateralize defined benefit-type promises to employees. Without getting into the technicalities of the different investment functions, namely the endowment fund problem and the defined benefit pension fund problem, investment professionals think about these in different ways, think of different investment objectives and different approaches. They would put together a different portfolio plan and treat them as different investment functions. As a consequence of the required separate treatment, that leads really to the third observation that I would make, and that is I don't think there would be material cost savings of consolidating the two, primarily because separate approaches would be required for the two types of funds. From what I understood of a potential type of structure for managing the pension funds of the permanent fund, there might be a single staff serving overlapping boards. That would seem to be organizationally difficult. I would think it would be very difficult for one staff to effectively serve two masters. The fifth point that I would make, and really the fifth and sixth may be the most important one, of having two separate investment operations within the state of Alaska regarding large pools of public money you would have a comparative framework, which otherwise would not be available if there was one single large-scale institutional investment function. And I think this is particularly important as it relates to the public interest and oversight of public money. And the comparative framework would exist in two respects. By virtue of the existence of two operations, it would be possible to observe and compare the policies employed in managing the two funds. And secondly, it would be possible to make appropriate. While I be desirable to create anything like a horse race, I don't mean that. But rather, I think there would be benefits of simply having available a comparative framework to evaluate policies, approaches, and results. Lastly, a benefit that I've observed is in this type of arrangement of having more than one investment operation within a state is diversification of oversight, not necessarily the pure investment portfolio diversification, but just different people brought together, different governance, and a distribution of the control and ultimately potential politicalization of the investment process. The model of all consolidated funds works well in some states. Multiple investment operations works well in others. But I think from a political diversification standpoint, if you will, there's some merits in not having all of the money under one roof. So those are some of my observations as I looked at the circumstances before you there, and I'd be happy to answer any questions on that subject or move to another topic.
Please proceed.
One of the other topics that thought a little bit about was the governance of the funds by a board and the kind of representation. And while there is a desire to not have these types of funds become to be subject to too much political pressure and to try to insulate these types of funds from politics, in reality that's not possible. It's not realistic. These are public monies, and there's a great deal of interest, and there always will be in their management. As I've looked at different states and worked in different states and examining the governance procedures for public pension funds, there seems to be an equilibrium when both the taxpayers and the beneficiaries have substantial representation on the board. Those are really the two constituencies that have an interest in the management of these assets. The taxpayers, from the standpoint of wanting to be sure that the funds are managed well enough so that no more money than is necessary has to be committed to them, and the monies are managed carefully. And the beneficiaries, the participants in the retirement systems, from the standpoint of making sure that the funds are sufficiently productive to provide the best benefit possible. And so, as you think about structuring oversight board for an investment corporation or whatever entity you're contemplating, I would think having substantial representation and largely balanced representation from those two constituencies is probably going to give you the most stability in the long run. I made some comments up there about the concept of an investment advisory component to the board. I think that's a good solid idea for you in Alaska because of the absence of a substantial institutional investment community.
It would be much of the investment management is going to have, you're going to have to look to professionals from the lower 48. A concern I would have, though, about incorporating such an advisory committee on the board itself, that I think raises some complications, and I suggested that you may wish to consider to have this a separate advisory council of people who do not bear the same fiduciary duties as the trustees or directors themselves would bear. I think that would be particularly important if you are bringing in from out of state members in an advisory type of capacity. By virtue of their not being citizens, they're top-notch people. I think their appetite for serving in such a capacity, even if paid, would be diminished if they had to bear fiduciary types of responsibility. Another area in which I spoke briefly when in Anchorage was with respect to what kind of people are required to sit on these boards, and how can legislators be assured that the job will get done right, particularly if many of the representatives are lay people. I think at the time they expressed great confidence in lay people to come to understand the problems of institutional investment and to retain expert advisors. And it takes takes a couple of years sitting on these boards and a lot of dedication. And I think people need to have terms of at least 4 to 6 years. But once the process gets established, I've discovered that that lay people sitting on these boards serve very effectively. And that one reason that that they do, I think, has to do with the relevance of the fiduciary standard that you've adopted there and most states are now using, namely the prudent person rule. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with it, but just to sort of paraphrase it, the prudent person rule requires fiduciaries to discharge their duties with care, skill, prudence, and diligence that a prudent person acting in a like capacity would use in the conduct of an enterprise of like character and with like aims. Now, the nice thing about that standard is that it requires of trustees and fiduciaries that they have a very good understanding of how other such entities conduct their business. It requires them to do surveys, to do research, to understand the policies and practices of others. It doesn't require them to mimic those, but it requires them to understand what are norms. And there are indeed norms for common stock percentages and bond percentages and these sorts of things. And it simply requires that fiduciaries have a good reason if they differ from norms. And I have observed that it's a very effective standard by which to guide the ordinary people in the management of these very important monies. And with that, I'll conclude and be happy to take any questions or further discussion from you all.
Mr. Ennis, thank you very much. Are there questions, Mr. Ennis?
Just one very quick
Representative
question. Would you care to comment on the question of whether or not the board should have the integrated functions, that is, both the investment questions and the management of the retirement systems, or do you have a preference? What has your experience told you about that question?
The integration or the combination of administrative oversight as well as investment oversight?
Correct.
I think it can work either way, and I don't think it has to be an important issue. As these funds have gotten larger and larger, listening to the gentleman from Washington, as I caught the last part of his comments, As I sit with boards of trustees throughout their sometimes two-day meetings and overseeing their retirement system, the investment agenda has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, and whereas some years ago it might only take an hour or two, now it typically takes one full day out of, a day and a half meeting with all other issues relating to the administration being reduced to maybe a half a day. And in some cases, they meet separately to review investments and separately administration. Really a separability in the minds of the groups that oversee these funds. So there would be no problem, I think, in only moving out investments under this oversight process. It might be best to simply take it one step at a time and to perhaps move investments initially and then administration. There certainly is no reason that that both cannot be done under one roof. That's commonly done, and it's natural, but more and more the time and energy is going into the investment side, and that probably as it should be.
Mr. Innes, thanks very much, and thanks again for your participation here last month. I think we all got a lot out of that. Thank you very much. It's about 3 o'clock. We're going to start in with our Department of Revenue and Department of Administration folks. What I'd like to do, if we can, is if we could take a five-minute break, and literally let's start in again in about 5 minutes.
You know, we've got to leave us.
Back to together again. This might be a good time to just read into the record a letter that I received from Mark Langland, chairman of the Permanent Fund. We had asked the Permanent Fund for their specific views on this investment as they were involved last session in proposals for involving the Permanent Fund in the management of PERS and TERS funding. And we don't have any representatives from the Permanent Fund here today, but the letter's very short. I'd like to read it into the record. At your request, the Board of Trustees discussed and voted on its position concerning the possible management of the PERS and TERS funds by the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. It was the unanimous vote of the Board that the trustees have no interest in assuming responsibility for the management of the PERS and TERS and other state investment funds that have actuarial and different liability obligations in the Alaska Permanent Fund. In general, it is the view of the trustees as well as the staff that the management of the Alaska Permanent Fund involves very different management philosophies than policies that are involved in the management of retirement funds. The potential of mixing the two types of policies in one organization was felt to be detrimental for both types of funds. The next person scheduled to testify, Commissioner Malone from our Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee today, and I particularly appreciate the attention that you and the members of your committee have given to this issue this year and before, and I'm very glad that we have in attendance also today the chairman of the House Finance Committee, Mr. Larson, Representative Ulmer and Representative Rieger, who were the champions of the cause of a credible public process for our investment programs and state government in the House. And I applaud your continuing interest, and I am confident.